The decades-long Cold War gave America the Atomic Age, the McCarthy era, and the House Un-American Activities Committee. That and a legacy of movies that both captured and helped create the time. Jim Hoberman is the senior film critic for The Village Voice. He writes about the films of the early Cold War in the book An Army of Phantoms, American Movies and the Making of the Cold War. He told Ann Strange Champs he thinks one of the most definitive Cold War films is The Next Voice You Hear.
God gets on the radio for 6 nights and speaks directly to the American people in somewhat the same way that FDR might have delivered his fireside chats, except, of course, you never hear the voice of God. You only get it through people's descriptions, or sometimes, you know, they write down what he says or paraphrases it.
What is it, Joe?
It was a kind of a funny thing on the radio just now. They announced it was exactly 8:30, and there was a kind of a funny empty sound. And then a voice said, "This is God. I'll be with you for the next few days."
Well, then what happened?
Nothing happened. The program came back on.
Well, it must be one of those mystery voice shows. You know, you have to guess whose voice.
Well, they usually tell you about the prizes first.
Or maybe one of those Orson Welles things.
Yeah.
Just as an aside, I have to say how very pleased I am that out of all the media, God chose radio.
Yes, and also one of the things that's very striking about this movie, which was released in the early summer of 1950, is that television is one of many significant things that are not mentioned.
Why do you think of this as a Cold War movie?
Well, for one thing, there's the tremendous anxiety behind it, you know, the desire, even the fantasy of this kind of divine intervention. And then I think that it's maybe difficult for us to imagine the impact that the atomic bomb had on people's consciousness in the, you know, years immediately following World War II. I mean, we've had a long time to adjust to it, if in fact we have, which, you know, is questionable. But then it really did seem to people that they could be living in the latter days. And significantly, God then began to play a very crucial part in American public life, which had really had not happened before, despite what people say now. There's a historical basis for this. I mean, Eisenhower ran in 1952, not just as somebody who had been the supreme commander of the Allied forces during World War II, but as a deeply religious man who had practically been called upon by God to become president. And the fact that his parents were Jehovah's Witnesses and thus, you know, would have been acutely aware of the separation between church and state is not something which, you know, seemed to have affected him. He was baptized in the White House, and he's the one who got In God We Trust put on the money and One Nation Under God inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance. Mm. And so in the early 50s, God really came back. I mean, the communists were routinely described as godless communists, which meant that as their opposites, we had to be godful Americans.
You also write about, during this period, you write about High Noon as, in some ways, an example of one response. It was made by a screenwriter who was an unfriendly witness before HUAC, right?
High Noon is the best-known example of a movie that allegorizes the blacklist. Although it didn't start out that way. I mean, what happened was that Carl Foreman, who had been a communist, was a screenwriter and producer, and he was subpoenaed while he was writing the movie. And he was struck and appalled by the fact how when people heard about this, they sort of ran from him. And eventually, you know, he lost his place in the company that put out High Noon. But he saw the movie as being a metaphor for the blacklist where only one guy in the town, the marshal, Gary Cooper, is willing to stand up against outlaws and everybody else turns their face away or runs away and so on.
A terror-stricken town left him to face four killers, single-handed, at High Noon. With every swing of the pendulum, with every second, a man's life ticked away. Never have so few moments held such excitement.
And one of the reasons why other people came to see the movie that way because not everybody did, is because Forman wrote to Bosley Crowther, the film critic for the New York Times then, and told him that that's what he was doing. Told him the backstory, that this was what the movie was about. And, you know, Forman did testify. He was essentially an unfriendly witness. I mean, he was willing to tell the committee that he had been a communist, but he wasn't going to name anybody else. And as a result, he was driven into exile.
Wow. That's such an interesting reading of the film. I guess I hadn't realized that. I've always thought it was just a classic, one of the classic Westerns, you know, small town marshal and a Western frontier. It never occurred to me it would have any connection to the HUAC experience.
Yeah. Well, of course, it did become the classic Western in a way. And it's a movie which is very much beloved by American politicians. It's the movie that's been shown the most in the White House. I mean, starting with Dwight D. Eisenhower, who screened it 3 times, through Clinton, who claimed it was his favorite movie and showed it evidently 20 times while he was president, and then made a point of telling Dan Rather that he was going to recommend it to George W. Bush.
Did any filmmakers make explicitly pro-communist or anti-capitalist movies? Did any just say, all right, I've already been blacklisted, now I'm going to make what I want?
There's only one example of blacklisted writers and directors and producers getting together to make a movie, and that's The Salt of the Earth, which was made in New Mexico in 1953 and concerns a strike by a miners union there. And it was made hand-to-mouth and with a tremendous amount of government interference, and not even covert government interference. I mean, the making of this movie became an issue on the floor of Congress. And there were all kinds of articles in the press suggesting that the movie was being financed by the Soviets, that the whole thing was an elaborate cover to spy on Los Alamos or, you know, like disrupt the uranium mines and so on. It's fantastic to read about this.
What's the plot of the movie?
The movie is a story of a strike. It's a very straightforward story of a strike, which involves mainly Mexican-American workers and how the mine owners attempt to break the strike. And people suffer, but in the end prevail. They're the salt of the earth. And, you know, it's a kind of a very straightforward sort of 1930s, you know, popular front narrative. And there's no mention of communism in the movie.
The men quarreled. They made brave speeches. It seemed the strike was lost.
Brother Chairman, if you read the court injunction carefully, you will see that it only prohibits striking miners from picketing. We women are not striking miners. We will take over your picket line. Don't laugh. We have a solution you have none. If women take your places on the picket line, the strike will not be broken, and no scabs will take your jobs.
Now, another film genre that came of age during this time, really was invented during this time, is science fiction films, which you could see as simply a response to the atomic bomb, the creation of this whole new science and the fear about atomic science. You write about it also, though, as a reflection of Cold War fears.
Science fiction was a genre which seemed something that, rather than being about the future, was about this new situation that the human race found ourselves in after the end of the war. And something which is a parallel to this is the flying saucer mania, which is also a historical thing. I mean, it begins in the summer of 1947 and continues more or less for another 5 or 6 years, where there were all these saucer sightings and so on. I think that Invasion of the Body Snatchers is the classic B-movie allegory of the period.
A moment's sleep and the girl I loved was an inhuman enemy bent on my destruction. That moment's sleep was death to Becky's soul, just as it had been for Jack and Teddy and Dan Kaufman and all the rest. Their bodies were now hosts harboring an alien form of life, a cosmic form, which to survive must take over every human man. My only hope was to get away from Santa Mira, to get to the highway, to warn the others of what was happening.
Look! You fools! You're in danger! You're next! You're next! You're...
What's fascinating about Invasion of the Body Snatchers, aside from the fact that it's, to this day it's a very effective movie, it works very well, very, very well directed and acted film, is that it has two readings. I mean, the movie was conceived and made by liberals, some of whom who had been communists, at least one of whom had been a communist who then turned around and named names. So it was made by people who experienced the Red Scare up close. And for them, it was a critique of conformity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the suburbs, the man in the gray flannel suit. Even McCarthyism was seen as a kind of conformist attitude, and just the danger that Americans surrendered their individual liberties and so on. But once the movie was out there, it was understood, not surprisingly, and first in Europe, as an allegory about, you know, that had to do with the fear of communism. And the thing that's in a way even more revealing is that to a large degree, when it opened, and it was not a hit at all. I mean, it was never even reviewed in the New York Times. Open in a theater in Manhattan, was that a lot of people just didn't get it. I mean, Variety reviews this movie, and they can't figure out what the premise is, you know? So it's like adding another level of denial to this thing. I mean, then, of course, it went on to become a tremendous, you know, a cult favorite, thanks to television mainly.
Jim, thanks so much for talking today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Jim Homberman is the senior film critic at The Village Voice and the author of An Army of Phantoms. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs.